Now let us turn in God's word to the book of Exodus and chapter 18. Exodus chapter 18. Reading from verse 1 of Exodus, the 18th chapter. When Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel his people, and that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt, then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back, and her two sons, of which the name of the one was Gershom, meaning a stranger there, for he said, I have been an alien in a strange land. And the name of the other was Eliezer, meaning my God is a help. For the God of my father, said he, was mine help, and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife unto Moses into the wilderness where he had camped at the Mount of God. And he said unto Moses, I, thy father-in-law Jethro, am come unto thee, and thy wife and her two sons with her. And Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, and did obeisance and kissed him. And they asked each other of their welfare, and they came into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done unto Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and all the travail that has come upon them by the way, and how the Lord delivered them. And Jethro rejoiced for all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, Blessed be the Lord who hath delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, and out of the hand of Pharaoh, who hath delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, for in the thing wherein they dealt proudly, he was above them. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God. And Aaron came, and all the elders of Israel, to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. Here Moses and the people of Israel are freed from their slavery in Egypt and have come to a place called Rephidim, chapter 17 and verse 1. Next will be Mount Sinai before moving on toward the land of Canaan. So much has happened to them since coming out of Egypt. The 10 plagues that came down upon Pharaoh and the Egyptians, which broke the will of that stubborn king and made him surrender, letting the people go. And then the Passover night and the Exodus and the release from Egypt, the journeyings thus far and the events on the way. Now here in Rephidim, as we read from verse 5, Moses is reunited with his family. Rephidim is near to Midian, where Moses' father-in-law Jethro lived, and where Zipporah and their two sons were. That's where they've been staying all the while Moses has been in Egypt. And Moses tells Jethro about what has happened since they last saw each other. Verse 8. Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done unto Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and all the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how the Lord delivered them. And you'll notice how Moses puts it in the second part of verse 8. He says it in a particular way. All the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how the Lord delivered them. He summarizes all that has happened since coming out of Egypt until this point. All the tremendous things that have taken place. And you'll notice what a godly way he has of expressing it. All the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how the Lord delivered them. Now that is different language from what Moses used to say. Back in chapter 3 and verse 11, when the Lord sent him to Pharaoh, gave him his permission to do this great work in God's name. Exodus 3 verse 11, Moses said unto God, "Who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh, and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt?" Such fearful words, excuse-making words, not godly, God-honoring words. And perhaps even worse was in chapter 5 verse 22, when they had made that first entrance to Pharaoh and demanded in God's name that he let the people go, and all it had done is enrage Pharaoh, and he increased the burdens of the Egyptians and made things far worse. And the elders of Egypt turned on Moses and Aaron and blamed them for their increased troubles. And it all seemed to have exploded in their faces. And incidentally, it's not the first time or the last time that God's people have found that when they're in the way of obedience and doing God's will, things go badly wrong. And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't have done it. It simply means that God is sovereign and taking his own way in these things. Moses and Aaron were doing the right thing, but it only makes matters 10 times worse. Anyway, Moses comes to God and he says, "Lord, wherefore hast thou so evil entreated this people? Why is it that thou hast sent me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in thy name, he hath done evil to this people, neither hast thou delivered thy people at all." Not good words. But you see, after all that God had proven himself to be to Moses, and all the way God had fulfilled his word, and done great things through Moses after all, and since coming out of Egypt to this place in Rephidim, the things that had happened along the way, now the language is this. All the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how the Lord delivered them. It's spiritual language now. It's acknowledging God. It's giving him the glory, being realistic that they have passed through trying events. But more than that, giving God the glory for his faithfulness to them. And dear friends, we must do the same. And when we have proved God's faithfulness to us, in spite of our complaints and distrust and unfaithfulness, when we've proved his faithfulness to us, let us express it spiritually. And let God, who has changed things for us, also change our language and cause us to express things in a way that is worthy and in a way that is to his glory. And we shall find that we will be even more blessed when we speak like that, and will be a blessing to others, because when Moses put it like that, Jethro rejoiced and said, "Now I know that God is greater than all supposed gods," and that kind of thing. Well now, let us listen to Moses here, and let us see what he is saying in the second part of verse 8. All the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how the Lord delivered them. And first of all, you have the difficulties. All the travail that has come upon them by the way. He's meaning, you see, what the journey had been like so far since coming out of Egypt. And he sums it up in this word, travail, which means hardship, distress, weariness. And he's not overstating it. You can go back over these chapters and you can see what he means. First of all, there was the Red Sea, and how that newly come out of Egypt, the Lord told them to take a certain route, which meant that they were in a cul-de-sac. And the Red Sea was in front of them, blocking their way. The Egyptians were pursuing them from behind, going to overtake them and recapture them, or perhaps even kill them. They couldn't turn to the right or the left because of mountains and wilderness. And it seemed as if God had left them in the lurch. And it was a terrible situation. And they cried to the Lord, and the Lord came in for them. But that was travail. And then next in chapter 15, there was that water shortage. And the way that they came to this oasis and this expanse of water. And my, how they were just so longing to drink to the full and slake their thirst. And as soon as they did so, they were coughing and spluttering. The water was brackish, it was bitter. They couldn't drink it. Mara, the waters of Mara. And that was a great disappointment. And the Lord dealt with that. Then in chapter 16, the food ran low. They began to be hungry. There was no food for them to eat. And the Lord sent, of course, the manna from heaven. There was that trial as well. And then in Rephidim, the opening of chapter 17, no water again. And the people complained, and have you brought us out, as they said to Moses, to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst. And the Lord dealt with that. And as if all that wasn't enough, travail. Then Amalek, the Amalekites, come to attack them. And they come from the rear, picking off the weakest and the old ones at the back of the company of the Israelites. And they have to fight a battle. And all these things, dear friends, in a matter of weeks. And if they thought being redeemed from Egypt was the end of all their troubles, they were greatly mistaken. It was really the beginning of other troubles. But compared to their slavery and sufferings in Egypt, these things that happened to them, by the way, were nothing. God had dealt with the greatest, and these other things, well, they should be looked at in the light of that. And we know that all these things are typical and patterns for Christian experience. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11. All these things happened unto them, says Paul, for examples or types, patterns, for us and for our admonition. And there are lessons in it. And you say, and you could say that these words of Moses are so true of every Christian's experience since conversion. All the travail that has come upon us by the way. It sometimes is a dismaying thing for new Christians. They're converted, they're redeemed by the precious blood, they're brought out to know the Lord, they have gospel liberty, they're new Christians, and they think that there aren't going to be troubles and sufferings and problems now because they're the Lord's people, and the Lord is going to give them a certain path that is going to be much better and easier than the path that unbelievers have. And to their dismay, they find that they got trials and they got temptations, they got struggles and challenges that they never would have had they not been Christians. And that's why, sadly, for some mere professors who are not really converted, but they profess to be so only, They say, well, if this is what it is to be a Christian, then I'm giving up. I can't stand this. It was better than what before I was converted. And the pliables of this world, as Pilgrim's Progress puts it, they go back. But true pilgrims go forward. And this is because real religion in this world will be, as Acts 14 verse 22 tells us, through much tribulation we must enter the kingdom of God. And if it is hard, then we only have to remind ourselves, compared to the service of Satan, compared to when we were in our sins and in this wicked world on the broad road that leads to destruction, compared with that, the joys and blessings and consolations of belonging to Christ and following Him, and the greater ones that are yet to come in glory, far outweigh the worst that we might know here. But it leaves the question, why does the life of faith have to be like this? Why is it not that the Lord, who delights to bless His people, why does He not, from conversion onwards and the new life, why does He not make it a smoother way, a happier way in that sense, a trouble-free way? And you might think, well, if unbelievers saw the life of Christians, that they had it so happy, and that nothing happened to them, and it was all so straightforward, maybe that would increase the value of their witness. And they would think, that's an additional reason for coming to Christ and being saved, because this is life more abundant, this is a better life than what I've got in the world. Why is it that Christians don't have an easier time of it than they do? And the answer, dear friends, is it has to be one of travail, because it is not safe for it to be otherwise for us. You see, when things are easy, is it not true that we tend to relax too much? And we can grow a little independent of the Lord, and we can become careless, self-sufficient, and the heart begins to harden because we're not made to feel our need of Him through these very things that come upon us. And we're not so much under the government of grace, and sadly carnal nature can take over. And when things are easier, it is not usual that we are more spiritual. You think of the example of Noah. While ever he was fearing the Lord, building the ark, making his witness to that generation, he was at his best, wasn't he? Hero of faith in Hebrews 11. And then through the time of the flood and so on, and they all came out afterwards and came out onto that newly cleansed world and began life again. He grew grapes, made wine, and got drunk. Because it was all over. The hard time of witnessing and serving God and having to trust the Lord for everything kept him. When it was all over, indulgence, sin. And the Lord knows, you see, how we would be. And so there has to be the travail to keep us. You think of Solomon following David. Everything was handed to Solomon, wasn't it? David had to fight the Lord's enemies and battles, and keep Israel safe, and make Israel a great nation under God, and supply Israel with psalms to sing and an ordered worship and so on. And all that was great struggle. And then it's all given over to Solomon, the man of peace. And Israel has rest on every side, and he reigns in all his voluptuous glory. And he starts making compromises. Chariots and horses from Egypt. multiplying wives. And at the end, following the false gods of his wives into idolatry when he's old. It's not safe for us to have it too easy. There's even danger, dear friends, in being spiritually elated and having a marvellous time, a mountaintop experience. There's danger even in that. You remember Hezekiah? He was told he was going to die. He prays 15 more years to live. It's a wonderful miracle. And ambassadors from Babylon come, very, very grateful for what has happened and marveling at this great turn of events, flattering Hezekiah, who shows them all his armoury and his weapons and his riches and things. And the Lord comes to him. And the writer in Chronicles says, when the Lord blessed him like that, his heart was lifted up in pride. You've got to be very careful. If things are too easy and smooth, if you're very blessed even, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. It's either that we tend to relax too much and leave off spiritually and expose ourselves to spiritual dangers, or it is that in the absence of trial and difficulty, we become absorbed with our pleasures and our pursuits. And life becomes so full of good things that we are tending to do, and devotions get squeezed, the quiet time is shortened, the Bible is not read so much, prayer, the throne of grace is not visited so much, affections are not on things above so much, the Lord's Day is not welcomed so much, because we've got all these other things now which are our happiness, and they're a great distraction to us. And we can even grow lukewarm toward the Lord because we've got so much and things are so easy. I guess that must be a great snare and danger to a man, say, who retires as a Christian. And he reaches retiring age and then he thinks to himself, and so many Christians have fallen foul with this. They say, right, we're going to move now to our favourite place that we visited on holiday, where we've always wanted to live. And so they up sticks and they settle in this wonderful paradise where they want to live, only to find they haven't thought about a local church. And now they're languishing and they're complaining they haven't got a church to go to. And that can be a terrible snare. And then the years pass by and all the weekends are taken up with visiting the grandchildren and caravan holidays over the weekends and maybe a church here, maybe a church there now and again, and worldliness settles in. How dangerous. I can tell you it's even a danger, dear friends, when we go on holiday. Certainly is for a minister. I must confess I've not yet solved this one by God's grace. But I don't know about other ministers, I can speak for myself, but when you're out of the discipline of the weekly routine of preparing sermons, pastoral visiting, and all the other gracious duties which belong to our calling, and then you go away for a week or two to somewhere else and you rest and you get up in the morning and you're out of the usual routine, and the danger is spirituality can go down and spiritual priorities are not the same. The Lord isn't sought and prayed to, and you don't walk with God the same way. I've got to be so careful. I must confess on holiday that I don't end up being less spiritual, less God-fearing, less close to the Lord than when I'm at home. You think, oh, surely that's not the case. I can tell you it is. I can say even that my day off
is a danger this way. I believe a pastor should have a day off. I said so before, and I'm a great believer in it. I don't prescribe to my fellow ministers, but I know that I need a day off. And so we take a day off, Mondays. Now, it's a wonderful thing to relax after the rigors and tiredness and so on of the Lord's day, as God has given help. You can relax for one day. But it's such a contrast. Then you're going to go back to it Tuesday, but Monday, what do you do with it? It can be a trial. I know that dear Mr. Morris Roberts, he has sometimes said, God, deliver me from my Mondays. I don't know quite what he meant by that, but I know what I mean. And he says, there's a danger. I'm saying, by way of illustration, it's what it amounts to is this. Having too much to do is more dangerous than having too little to do. And being up against it in pressures and stresses is sometimes safer than having it very easy and smooth. Because anything that causes us to feel our need of Him and depend on Him utterly for the next thing that we need is very good for us, can be sanctified to us, can have a spiritually quickening effect. All the travail. And we learn, dear friends, that the travail is so good for us and so necessary for us and is appointed by God for our good. And we would not be anything like what we are without it. If we were spared it, it would not be for our good. And believe you me, the Lord knows exactly what travel is like and how much of it and how often and what its effect will be and so on. The Lord gets it right every time. All the travail that had come upon us by the way. And if we could look back down through our lives, and if we had kept a spiritual journal or a diary, we would see that those times that have been hardest in life have been those times when we've known God more, much more than those seasons when things have gone swimmingly well. Let me illustrate it by this homely little story. A little girl was walking in a garden and she noticed a particularly beautiful flower. She admired its beauty and enjoyed its fragrance. Now, some little girls here and boys, and if you're walking in a garden and you see these lovely flowers, well, this little girl was doing that, and she spotted one in particular. And she followed her eyes, followed her with her eyes down to the stem, and she said, ugh, it's growing in dirt, dirty soil. That's not where it should be. She pulled it up, and she took it to the tap, and she washed the roots with the water. And after a time, you know what happened? The flower wilted and died. And the owner of the garden, when he saw what had happened, he said to her, why have you done that? You've destroyed my finest flower. And she said, well, I didn't like to see it in that dirt. And the gardener replied, I chose that spot and mixed the soil because I knew that only there it could grow to be a beautiful flower. And the point is, you see, we can be tempted to complain at our difficult circumstances where God has planted us. But it's in those very circumstances and the recurrence of the travail where things are mixed and combined together to cause us to blossom spiritually and to grow up unto Him and to glorify Him, and to be taken out of our circumstances, put somewhere else, would not be the answer. We might be tempted to think so. Oh, if only I could have a different situation. If I could be spared all this and be elsewhere. Oh, that I had wings like a dove, that I could fly away and be at rest in some wilderness. My dear friend, it would not be good for you spiritually. Where the Lord has put you and what He's combined for you is the best. And the Lord knows what He's doing. The difficulties are the very things that the Lord is using to make them a blessing and make you a blessing. And there's a lovely quote from one of the Puritans, George Downham, who was born in Chester, near us up in North Wales. And he says that our travail is matched to how the Lord thinks we will cope. And Downham puts it like this: the Lord does not measure out our afflictions according to our faults, but according to our strength, and looks not at what we have deserved, but at what we are able to bear. The Lord does not measure out our afflictions according to our faults, but according to our strength, and looks not at what we have deserved, but at what we are able to bear. And my dear friend, I can say to you that if the Lord has laid upon you a particularly heavy travail, don't you see that that's the measure of His regard for you and His confidence in you, that by His grace you will blossom under it and you will be at your best spiritually and you will give Him glory. And so, the difficulties, what would we do without them? Secondly, as we conclude, not only the difficulties, but the deliverance. All the travail, but, and how the Lord delivered them. And you see, the two always go together, don't they? All the travail, and how the Lord delivered them. And Moses approved that, and he could testify to it. And that conjunction, and, it's a very vital one in God's word. You've got all the travail, the difficulties of trials, and then and. And you can't do without that. It's God's and. It's the other side of the story. The Lord never leaves this out, and neither should we. What was it that proved to be the and the Lord's delivering them? Well, one thing that the Lord did was this. He granted them His loving presence. Are you in the midst of travail and trouble and difficulty? You are also accompanied by God in them. They're remarkable words in Hebrews 8 and verse 9. Quoting Jeremiah chapter 31. The covenant I made with their fathers, the Israelites here, in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt. You've got to read that again, haven't you? I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt. That's how the Lord expresses it. All these Israelites, in their travail, God was holding their hand as He was leading them out. And along the way, through all these travailing circumstances, we know that the Lord can do that, because to every godly one, the Lord draws near individually, and they feel that He is holding their hand. And so He is. And that verse in Isaiah 41, verse 13, is made good. I, the Lord, will hold thy right hand, saying unto thee, fear not, I will help thee. What a golden word that is, isn't it? In your travail and in your circumstances, I, the Lord thy God, covenant God, will hold thy right hand, saying unto thee, fear not, I have help. I will help thee. I don't know about other ministers, but I've used this verse so often in a pastoral way to people in trouble, saints on their dying bed. And it's a precious word, isn't it? He's holding you by the hand. Do you remember Asaph in Psalm 73? With the great struggle he had in his mind about the prosperity of the wicked and how the godly are tried every day, including him, and how he stumbled at this and couldn't understand how that could be fair and so on. And he was brought through to a right understanding. But he says at one point, he says, "Nevertheless, I am still with thee. Thou hast holden me by my right hand." God had hold of me. I was in his presence when I was as a beast and so ignorant before him, reasoning so wrongly and carnally and almost going over the edge and losing faith and confidence. And that's the only explanation why any of us have kept, isn't it? It's God who keeps hold of us. Believe that he's holding your hand and he's bringing you closer to him as he does so. And you'll know more of his loving presence and his grace. And not only his loving presence and this deliverance, but there is such a deliverance, dear friends, that can be described as not necessarily deliverance from, but deliverance in. And that's how it was so often, wasn't it? You think of those things that we mentioned earlier that belong to the travail. The first was the Red Sea. Well, what about that? How the Lord delivered them. How did he deliver them? Well, he didn't actually deliver them from the Red Sea, did he? When they were shut up and at a dead end and in desperate straits, he delivered them in it, because he opened the waters of the Red Sea and they went through on dry land. And you see, if you're facing an impossible situation as part of your travail, God can open the way through it. He says in Isaiah, doesn't he? "I will make all my mountains a way." How can mountains be a way when they're blocking your path impossibly? Well, he can level them and you can go through. It's not usual that we're taken right out of the situation, although sometimes God does it that way. It's more usually that we're helped through it. And the best we can say is, "I am being helped through, and I'm being blessed through it." And then, what about the water shortage at Marah? Remember that oasis and that wonderful pool of water? And they all dropped down and they began to drink it and found it was bitter, brackish, poisonous. Well, God didn't suddenly replace it. He threw something in it. He told Moses to throw a branch of a tree in it, and miraculously, the water became sweet. And they were able to drink it. And dear friend, that stands for how that the Lord can sweeten our trials. And instead of them being bitter to us, there can be a strange sweetness in them, because we know so much of God in them. There's a line of a hymn, a couple of lines of a hymn, and the writer says, "Because there is, I daily find a secret sweetness." Sorry, "a secret something sweetens all. I daily find a secret something sweetens all." Well, of course, it's his presence, isn't it? He's delivering in us and enabling us to be spiritually blessed. The food shortage? Well, they weren't taken out of the wilderness where there was no food, but the manna came daily. Daily they were provided for. Day by day, the manna fell. Oh, to learn the lesson well, that daily came that provision. And as we have the needs, so the needs will be provided for. You might not see next day's needs today, but you go out into the day like they did and you find the manna waiting for you. Deliverance in, you see. And then the water shortage at Rephidim. Well, the rock gave forth the water. Most unexpectedly, God can raise up from these stones children unto Abraham. Amalek Well, Joshua went out and fought with Amalek, and God gave them the victory. There was a deliverance in these things. So they were able to cope, and they were led through. And God proved himself faithful and sufficient. And so will it be with us. There's that marvelous word in Genesis chapter 41 and verse 52 concerning Joseph, who named his sons like Moses named his, and one of them was called Ephraim, which means fruitful, and it commemorated this fact: Ephraim, fruitful, for God hath caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. Why? And the Lord was with Joseph. And the Lord was with Joseph. Made him a prosperous man, even in the midst. Deliverance in the situation. To prosper within it. Growing grace, knowledge of God, experience of the Lord. All these good things that could never come if we had a smooth path that would make us spiritually flabby and weak and unfruitful. And then finally, lastly, all this was on the way to Canaan, wasn't it? On the way to Canaan. And dear friends, if they were going to have the promised land, if God had provided that great land of rest, Canaan, the inheritance, well, he's going to help them all the way through towards it, isn't he? And for us, if God has promised us heaven, is he going to fail us with all our present needs on the way there? As Richard Baxter puts it, he that hath made my heaven secure will here all good provide. It is guaranteed to us. And that land of rest will make up for everything and will prove that God has been faithful all the way through. John Trapp, the Puritan, puts it like this: he that rides to be crowned will not think much of a rainy day. Here's the prince on his way to the coronation, going to inherit the throne and the kingdom. It's raining. My, does that matter? A few drops of rain? And he's on the way to this great thing. And he that rides to be crowned in glory will not think much of a rainy day. We don't minimize the severity and difficulty of trials, but we should maximize the grace and the blessing God gives to us in them. All the difficulties and the deliverance. May it be so, for the glory of his name. Amen.